broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City, 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Why is it important for fiction writers to read? Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Lynn Schwartz is in our studio today to help us understand why it is important for writers to read. Welcome to the Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today, Lynn.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Lynn is the founder of Writer's Word House, which offers writing and creativity workshops, live events, teleseminars, ghostwriting, private story development and assessment, editing, and coaching. Lynn, tell us a little bit about Writer's Word House.
Well, okay. For a decade now, I've been teaching fiction workshops, and I found that when students finished the workshop, they would say, "Now what?" And so I felt there was a need to have some support, continued support and encouragement. And so we do all kinds of eclectic things for beginning and experienced writers.
Well, let me say that more information on Writer's Word House can be found at www.writerswordhouse.com. Lynn also teaches fiction at St. John's College, a course that welcomes both St. John's students and community members in Annapolis, Maryland, and also teaches life stories at the Writers Center in Annapolis and Bethesda. She holds a BA in literature writing from Columbia University, an MA in writing from the City College of New York, and is a graduate of the professional New York City Acting School, the Neighborhood Playhouse, School of the Theater. Her plays and staged readings have been performed in Atlanta and New York City, including the Bruno Walter Auditorium at Lincoln Center. Her short stories have been published in literary journals, and she was the founder and curator of the Temple Bar Literary Reading Series in New York City, which hosted many renowned authors, including Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award recipients. In 2008 and again in 2013, Lynn was awarded an Individual Artist Award in Fiction from the Maryland State Arts Council. She also profiles celebrity chefs for an online magazine and writes lifestyle pieces for regional publications. Lynn, it's so good to have you here today. Let's get right into our topic. Why is it essential for writers to read?
Well, I think if we love words, and writers do, we read for pleasure. Writers really need to read to understand story. What are the components of story? So the best reason for a writer to read is to learn to write well for education. It's also for inspiration for any of us. We can witness from other master writers what's been done on the page. We can expand our knowledge. We can identify the tricks of the trade, so to speak. So it brings up, when we're reading, our own memories that might give us new ideas for new pieces of work.
I find for myself that it really stokes my imagination when I read, that the work of other writers causes me to reach down into some places that I haven't looked before, and that all of a sudden I find, wait a minute, I want to write about this as well. And I guess that's the inspiration part of writing, as well as stoking the imagination. Well, as a writer, what should I read?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? I mean, I guess the common answers are always you've got to read the classics, which is, of course, true. It's invaluable. But I think you need to read many things, and you need to read well. So rereading comes into play. It's how we read something, and we can only really learn when we start to reread. So you can start with the classics, but if you're a mystery writer, you need to read the best mystery that's current and come before you. There are these lists, you know, where we're told if we're going to be an educated or thoughtful person. You must read, for instance, Ulysses. That's generally number one. But you'll find another list which says skip Ulysses, skip Moby Dick. So it becomes down to a personal choice. You know, read what you love. Read what you're trying to learn, what you're trying to improve.
One of the writing books, books on how to write that I read, echoed your comments, said you should read everything from the classics to the back of cereal boxes.
Well, exactly. We're learning about human behavior, about psychology, about philosophy, you know, all kinds of things. And everything can help. Religion, anything. It all contains story and can only expand our knowledge when we then hit the page.
Should you read the kind of books that you're hoping to write yourself?
Absolutely. You have to know what's out there and get a sense of what's being written today. If you're writing mystery, you want to read the best mystery, but from past, you may read Poe and you may read Walter Mosley today. So, but I don't think a writer should stay confined to their little genre writing box. I think you have to expand and understand other genres, all things. We can learn from everything, including movies, plays.
So to be conversant with, in addition to reading, to be conversant with all of the arts is important for a writer.
Absolutely. If we read plays, we learn about dialogue, poetry, description. You can read a travelogue and get a sense of setting and place. So all of these things help.
Yeah. If I want my writing to have literary substance, now, what should I read if I'm really aiming for that kind of philosophical, psychological substance that we find in perhaps Kafka and in the great writers?
Well, you're talking about what people are afraid to call but literary fiction. That's kind of a complicated word, and people shy away from it. But you're looking at, again, books that are wrestling with the human dilemma and human behavior. They're layered books. They're books that concentrate on language and that sort of is more satisfying. Well, I shouldn't say more satisfying, because a good romance novel can be satisfying to many. But if you're trying to be a literary writer, you do need to pay attention to language and the universal.
What should I pay attention to in terms of language? If I'm reading the great works, for example, Faulkner or Melville. What about language do I want to pay attention to?
Well, language is interesting, and it sort of encompasses our own style, our inflections of how we speak end up on the page, our rhythms, you know, our sentences. Are they long? Are they short? And all of this sort of comes under style. I had and language is one of the four important elements when you're reading critically that you should study. And it's a tough one. I had a writing mentor once, and I always remember this. And when he was a young man, he reported to the desk every day. He had that discipline, but he had nothing to write. So he began to copy books that he loved by hand, sentence by sentence. And then eventually, naturally, he began to leave those books and start to write on his own, developing his own style. Of course, he had been influenced by that, but he went off on his own. And I always love that, because I think that copying by hand something that you love, you're not trying to steal it, but that's the best way to get a sense of the rhythm and the language and how it all connects, and to really digest it and get it inside of you.
Well, you're talking about craft now, and there certainly is a craft to writing. I had one guest who commented that when he wrote stream of consciousness, and then he had to sit down and beat it into shape by applying what he knew of craft. So, what are the you mentioned them a little, but what are the basic craft elements, and how should I approach those in my reading?
Well, there are many. Probably, you know, we could do the top 10, but I'll just discuss four today. And we just talked about language. Character is really important. And when you're reading and you want to read critically, and when you reread, you want to see how that author has presented a character, an in-depth character. When I read a lot of beginning work and even work that's more experienced, and I would say the number one problem is that the character is superficial or formulaic. So how do you make a difference for that? I think instead of describing that Mary had blue eyes and a little mole on her cheek, it's better to talk about Mary's psychology. What are the choices that Mary makes, if you can describe that? Because those are things that Mary controls. And I think that's how you reach that in-depth character. And different authors do it different ways. So if you see a description of a character that's excellent or really gets into the psychology, I think you should really study that and see how that author did that.
Can you mention an author that you think does a particularly good job with character development?
Absolutely. I have a favorite that I bring into my classes, and this is an excerpt from The End of the Alphabet by C.S. Richardson. And if you'll notice, he really finds unique ways to describe his character, and I think when we're finished, we get to know him pretty well. Everything Ambrose Zephyr knew about cuisine, he learned from his wife. He was allowed in the kitchen, but under no circumstances was he to touch anything. He was a courageous eater, save Brussels sprouts and clams. His knowledge of wine was vague and best defined as Napa good, Australian better, French better still. Kir Royale was his drink of occasion. For an Englishman, he made a poor cup of tea. He believed women to be quantifiably wiser than men. He was neither a breast nor a leg man nor an ass man. Hair could be any length, any color. Ambrose preferred the complete puzzle to a bit here, a piece there. Those who knew him described Ambrose Zephyr as a better man than some, wanting a few minor adjustments, they would admit, but didn't we all? His wife described him as the only man she had loved, without adjustment.
Without adjustment.
Yes.
I'm not going to venture there. But even the name for this character is clearly important, because as soon as we run into the name Ambrose, right, we have a picture of him in our mind. And I have to say that the reading that you just did verified the picture of Ambrose that came to my mind. Well, what are the other? You say there are a few other major.
Well, the top floor, we talked about top four, talked about language and character. And then plot goes hand in hand. You know, character drives the plot. The plot grows organically out of our character's yearnings, and that's what keeps it from being superficial. In the old days, you know, we had the best-selling plot stories, and then the literary fiction was focused on character. Today, readers expect both. They expect a good plot or story and a character in depth. So you want to study how an author is presenting that. And often, I like to look at beginnings, because they often set up all the clues, not all, but many of the clues, the expectations that you're going to find in the book, the conflicts that will unravel. And you find those clues. So I have another excerpt if you'd like me to
read
that, because I think it illustrates it well. But, you know, I look at a lot of first sentences and a lot of first paragraphs. I think that's really important when you're reading. And usually if a first paragraph states something to be true, in fact, by the end of the story, the end of the novel, that probably will not be true. Right? This is from Amy Tan, who's a wonderful writer. It's a story called Two Kinds, and it was part of the Joy Luck Club. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you can see right from the beginning that the story is going to touch on the immigrant experience, the conflicts with East and West, and the mother-daughter generational conflicts. So this is Two Kinds. My mother believed you could be anything you wanted to be in America. You could open a restaurant. You could work for the government and get good retirement. You could buy a house with almost no money down. You could become rich. You could become instantly famous. Of course you can be prodigy too, my mother told me when I was 9. You can be best anything. What does Auntie Lindo know? Her daughter, she is only best tricky. America was where all my mother's hopes lay. She had come here in 1949 after losing everything in China. Her mother and father, her family home, her first husband, and 2 daughters, twin baby girls. But she never looked back with regret. There were so many ways for things to get better.
Mm. I've also often heard that, two things. That one, that plot is the why. The why of things are happening. And you know, I'm sure, the great line. The king died. The queen died. That's a narrative. But the king died. The queen died of grief.
Yes.
Is a plot.
That's
would,
right.
Would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. What I say a lot with plot is that something has to happen that matters. You always have to raise the stake. It has to matter. It can't just be that you have a farm and write beautiful sentences about the setting of the farm. Something has to happen on that farm. It can't be that your children are perfect and your wife is lovely and life is good. Something must happen that causes a character to change their worldview, their perspective. It's really comes down to, I think Stanley Elkin says, he wouldn't write about anybody who wasn't at the end of their rope. So we're looking at characters who are facing real dilemmas and on the verge of change.
One great writer on writing, Aristotle actually, said that in order for there to be a plot, there must be a reversal. What is a reversal?
Well, it comes down again to things have to change. If you have a character strolling along, it's a one note. It's very linear. So something climatic has to happen to turn that around. And, you know, if you follow a plot that follows a quest, is a basic plot that many people use, and it's primitive storytelling, it works well. So you've got your character in their ordinary world. Something has to happen to pull them out of that world. Now they're on a journey. They will set up what are their yearnings. What did they want? That's not the story, or as you say, the reversal. The story is, why can't they get what they want? Because if they can get what they want, you don't have a story.
Or what happens that keeps them from getting what they want?
And maybe in the end they get it, or maybe they decide that's not what they wanted anyway. We see that in romantic comedy all along. We don't want the bad boy in the end that we thought we did. It was the best friend who was the good guy all along. So those are the reversals.
And then, the other big element, it seems to me, is dialogue. And we've hit on that a little bit. But say a little bit about dialogue. What do we look for as we're reading in dialogue?
That's a great question. And dialogue is an important tool that people panic over. They get very intimidated by it. I really suggest reading plays for dialogue or even watching good movies. Dialogue is not just people talking. If you'll hear now, I'll have a lot of hums and pauses and corrections. That doesn't need to be on the page. So it's a highly stylized version of what sounds real. And dialogue wants to reveal character, create conflict or propel the plot forward. So one of the biggest mistakes in dialogue is filler dialogue. And filler is, "Hi, Hal. Would you like to come in and have a cup of tea?" "Sure, Lynn. I'd be delighted." "What kind of tea would you like, Hal?" "It's not interesting. Who cares?" Maybe that really is how we talk, but it's not going to help our story. So you want to really look at the dialogue from good authors, and how do they present it? How do they get right to the heart of the matter and use those three things?
Well, let me ask you, and when we don't want to dwell long on the elements, but you mentioned language and rhythm early on. I'm particularly interested in the rhythm of writing. What do I look for when I read that will help me establish some kind of rhythm within my own writing?
And that comes from within. When you practice a lot and you can write good sentences, but it's the diversity of the sentence, the variations in the sentence lengths, long words, short words. It's in the punctuation. It's having a paragraph that has maybe one word. It's a mixing it up into a very spicy stew, so to speak, so that it's not all the same. And that will offer your own rhythm. My rhythm is going to be different from yours.
Lynn, is there ever a time when I might not want to be reading?
Well, you can argue this both ways, but I know many writers, myself included, if you're working on a big project in the middle of the creative process, you don't want a lot of distraction. And so you may have read a lot before and a lot after, but you don't want to read right then. On the other hand, I know writers who write historical fiction, and they're immersed in reading journals, letters, history books, novels of that period. And they want to read it because they want to have that sensibility of language inside of them so that as they're hitting the page, they're not sounding contemporary. So it's a personal choice.
How about critique groups? Should I join a critique group or pardon the expression, is it more like the blind leading the blind here?
I think critique groups are very important. If you have the right group for your writing, you have to have people that respect your sensibility. People, you don't want somebody to read your work and say, I write romance, I don't like literary fiction. So they have to respect your style of writing. I read a lot of beginning writing, and you can't limit yourself to beginning writing, for sure. That will mess you up. But I think you can learn. I actually learn a lot from reading beginning writing, because you puzzle over, where's the story? How could this be better? Where's the problem? And sometimes you find wonderful things, too, new and fresh and unique things that you'll find sometimes when people are writing when English is a second language, they write something really unexpected on the page. So I absolutely read all the beginning writing you want if you're looking at how you can make it better or what's good about it, but then don't forget to read the masters.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're talking about reading. How about reading your own work? How should you read the work that you have written? Is it helpful, for example, to read your own writing aloud?
Absolutely. I do it all the time. It's mandatory for dialogue. It's very helpful for everything. You will hear, if you read your work aloud, you will hear those clunkers. You will hear the rhythm that doesn't work. You will hear the where it's not clear. Instantly. Some people will tape their work and then listen back to it. That's also a really excellent way of hearing those sentences that don't work at all and are not clear. Clarity's very big.
I find in reading aloud, any kind of work reading aloud, that you get a better sense of the rhythm and the pace of the work. Is that helpful in reading your own work aloud?
Absolutely. Some people compose reading it aloud.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be for everyone, but that can help too.
Right.
So absolutely.
Lynn, what are you reading? We're talking about what all these writers should read, and you've mentioned a lot of works, but what are you reading now? If I were to go out into the lobby and crack that big handbag open that you carried in, what book would I find tucked away in there?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm big on rereading. And I am rereading Olive Kitteridge by Elizabeth Strout, in particular the chapter called Little Burst. It's a story that I think is quite magnificent and very masterful. I'm also rereading Let the Great World Spin by Colin McCann. I'm on my second reading now, and I'll probably read this book 5 times. The way he puts it together like a masterful puzzle is quite amazing.
So what you've hit on here is rereading and how important. Say something about rereading and how important it is that we reread good works.
Well, I read once, just like anybody, for pleasure. I'm not looking necessarily how it's put together. So once I finish it and have found it very satisfying, then I reread it and I try to figure out what techniques they've used, what little tricks have they used, what makes it so good. So I'll read a book. I've read Pride and Prejudice 8 times.
Oh, yeah. Well, speaking of rereading, you brought a piece of your own writing. And I would like for you to read a portion of that if you don't mind.
I'm sorry, you want me to just go from here to here? Okay. This is takes place in New York City. With Dieter, a German-born Jew who owns the trendy restaurant Oh No Noho, and Dieter's wife Silke, who's an Austrian artist, and Juniper is the young mistress. The Viennese Silke lives above the restaurant on the 8th floor of the building, one of the many buildings Dieter owns. It's a pre-war architectural standout that has been renovated into large lofts with painted white floors. Silke has claimed the top floor, the space with the most light for her studio. Here she paints enormous canvases of artificial young women with vacuous eyes who have been cut to pieces by oversized scissors, or floating women with frogs placed at their crotch, women with polka dot skin and blue hair who open their robes wide apart, flashing their panties. The women in the paintings are high fashion, the skirt of a halter dress in full swing, a bathing cap with an exotic bird. I have heard that Silke herself used to parade outrageous attention-getting attire, attending formal galas at the Met in a man's tuxedo, or accenting a zebra-striped gown with a gas mask. But since I've known her, she wears corduroy pants, shiny red lace-up boots, and sunglasses. Her hair is dyed black, cropped short, spiky. Silke invites me and several of the restaurant managers and the Dominican dishwasher to her loft to help with her latest art installation. It's not so much an invitation, but a command, since we are Dieter's employees. Make sure Juniper comes, too, Silke tells me. I do, and I can't believe that Juniper is brazen or oblivious enough to accept. When the 12 of us arrive, we are told to pick a partner. And Silke says loud enough for everyone to hear, Dieter, why don't you pair up with Juniper? We all hold our breath, since everyone knows, even the Dominican dishwasher who speaks no English, that Dieter has now taken to calling his new love interest Jumpin' Junie. Juniper adores this little gift of affection, drags it around like the comforting blanket of a worried child.
That's absolutely beautiful, and I was taken with the opening paragraph describing Silke and her artwork, and I have to say it is so New York that it took me back to the sidewalk and the smell, even though you don't mention it, it's there, the smell of the exhaust, the grit that you feel, and then the vibrance and excitement of the city, I think are captured in that opening paragraph. And I particularly also the striped dress and the gas mask. Mm-hmm. And I thought immediately of Edward Weston's old 1942 photograph of the nude in the gas mask. Well, Lynn Schwartz, Thank you for joining us on Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, everyone, pens down for a moment and crack open that great novel, Gathering Dust, on the table. Faulkner, Joyce, Monroe, Prue, and many others know how to do it and do it well. Read them, enjoy them, learn from them. This is your host, Harold Wilson. Thank you for listening to Delmarva Today, the Writer's Edition.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.